The committee will now come to order. We don't yet have a quorum, so we'll, we're going to skip past adopting the committee rules right now. They're very much the same as our HHS reform rules. I think we've only made a few substantive changes. But we'll, since we don't yet have a quorum, we'll skip back that, past that. Representative Newton, your bill, since we don't have a quorum, we won't be able to move your bill. It's House File 2366. We have the bill before us, and I'm not aware of any amendments for your bill. Really?
Really?
Really, Tony? Peace out.
And of all the members of this committee, you're going to give cookies to. And it's not me.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know the standard procedure is to bribe all the committee members when you appear before the committee for the first time. So I'm honored to be the first person to appear before your committee. And now that Representative Albright is here, I guess we can move ahead.
Please begin, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'm introducing House File 2366, which is a bill to create a path to licensure for music therapists, and it would require that anyone that who acts in the capacity of music therapist is licensed in the state of Minnesota. You know, we've come to recognize the value of music therapists in the treatment of children suffering from autism in our schools, especially veterans and others suffering from PTSD, and something that you and I have worked on, Mr. Chair, is the traumatic brain injury, as well as, you know, individuals with mental health issues. Currently, 7 states do license music therapists. We'd like to be the 8th state. This bill has passed both the Senate Health and Human Services Committee and the Senate State and Local Government Committee, and it has been referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee, where it's currently sitting. Senator Sharon supports the bill and wants to move it forward. However, she does not want to move it forward logically unless it goes through your committee and on to Representative Mack's committee. As you know, Mr. Chair, because we're going to have such a short, fast, furious session, we want to get the bill moving as quickly as possible, but at least it's going through the Senate, and we're going to be able to make the deadlines through the Senate. So at this point, I would like to turn testimony over to Mr. Todd Schwartzberg, who's the chair of the music therapy program at the University of Minnesota, and he will also have 2 other people who would like to testify. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartzberg. If you could begin your testimony. Because of the amount of testifiers we have today, we're going to ask people to limit their testimony to around 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the members of the subcommittee. My name is Amy Furman. I'm a board-certified music therapist and the lead music therapist for the Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm the immediate past president of the American Music Therapy Association and a DINA resident. We want to speak today on behalf of House File 2366. In your folders, you will find definitions and clear information about the bill. State licensure will help ensure that Minnesotans have access to music therapy services by personnel who are trained, equipped, held to high standards of ethics and professional practice, and demonstrate competency through board certification and continuing education requirements.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, my name is Todd Schwartzberg, and I'm a board-certified music therapist working as a professor and clinician in the music therapy program at the University of Minnesota. I'm also the president of the board of directors of the Autism Society of Minnesota and serve as the chair for our Music Therapy Task Force on Licensure. I'm a resident of Shakopee. Official state recognition of the music therapy board certification credential will help healthcare facilities which rely upon state regulations avoid the confusion regarding the difference between music therapists, music practitioners, music thanatologists, and other non-music therapy musicians in healthcare. We are by no means attempting to regulate other professions. We want to ensure the public is protected if individuals present themselves as music therapists by requiring that these music therapists have met national standards of clinical practice. This proposed legislation offers a mechanism, licensure, as a viable solution with minimal government involvement. We feel this is a low-cost approach for the government and taxpayer, as we hope it will be budget neutral. We propose a voluntary music therapy advisory council, which will oversee license registration, re-registration, associated sanctions, and fines. Moreover, the license would be self-funded by fees assessed to board-certified music therapists.
Good morning. Morning. Mr. Chair, with your permission, my name is Barbara Els. I'm a new resident to Minnesota. I'm a proud resident of Rochester, Minnesota now. I'm the senior advisor of policy and research with the American Music Therapy Association and a board-certified music therapist. We have the support of myriad stakeholders, including family members, consumers, organizations, practicing board-certified music therapists, as well as our allied healthcare and special education professionals working around the state. Furthermore, this proposed legislation recognizes our clearly defined scope of practice, our clinical standards, and aligns with our required national board certification and continuing education requirements. My colleagues, clients, students, and I thank you for your time and attention to and support for this bill. I, along with my colleagues, are available for any questions you may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Els. Do we have any questions for the testifiers at this time? Not seeing any questions at this time. I know we have a testifier in the audience that would wish to oppose this bill. And Mr. McGrath, if you'd come down and testify.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Newton, thank you this morning for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 2366. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is one of the leading advocates of economic liberty and free labor markets. My colleagues have published the landmark publication License to Work, which shows the burdens that occupational licensing puts on individuals in their pursuit of their calling. Our research and our advocacy in state legislatures as well as in courts causes us to have great skepticism about occupational licensing. So this morning I'd like to talk about just three things. One is the bipartisan skepticism that is shared by other organizations in addition to the Institute for Justice. Secondly, the need for consistent thinking about what licensing really is. And thirdly, if I could be so bold, Mr. Chairman, to suggest that this legislation as well as the next one is legislative malpractice in light of the United States Supreme Court's decision in North Carolina Dental Board versus the Federal Trade Commission. So going to the first issue, the bipartisan organizations across the political spectrum are now highly skeptical about occupational licensing. On the left, we have friends who we've worked with at the White House, at the Council of Economic Advisors, which put out a paper demonstrating the skepticism about its skepticism. The Federal Trade Commission, even the Brookings Institute. Also on the left is Governor Jerry Brown, and I've submitted to this committee Governor Brown's veto of this type of licensure, stating that certification, private certification, is significant and sufficient to meet the needs for a market signal. On the right, we are joined by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, Americans for Prosperity, Morris Kleiner, the world's leading scholar who is at the University of Minnesota. As far as I can tell, Mr. Chairman, there is no public policy institution in America or in levels of the federal government that supports this level of occupational licensing. From a political perspective, Mr. Chairman, I would submit to you that you cannot be in favor of free markets and support occupational licensing. You cannot be in favor of the right to work and support occupational licensing. You cannot be in favor of limited government or economic liberty. You cannot be a conservative or a libertarian and support occupational licensing. And for my friends on the left, I'm happy to answer questions about this, but I submit to you that you cannot be in favor of social justice and support occupational licensing. Mr. Chairman, my third point is that this is legislative malpractice. The United States Supreme Court came out in a year ago on February 25th with the North Carolina Dental Board, and it removed the immunity from antitrust litigation on state licensing boards and identified the elements of removing that immunity. And those elements are in this bill. This bill proposes a board controlled and captured by the industry, in which the controlling factors are controlling members are private providers. Now, if these private providers got together at a country club or a restaurant and decided who could enter the market, it would be clear to you that it's an anti-competitive restraint of trade. But they get together in an office building, a government office building, and they're doing the very same thing. They are restricting who can enter the field. So not only is this was the issue that Governor Brown recognized, that this is anti-competitive and anti-opportunity, but here in Minnesota it is also contrary to Statute 214. I have not seen an analysis from this group per the requirements of Statute 214. So I'd ask this committee to not advance this bill any further, and I'm happy to answer any questions about my rather succinct and breathless presentation this morning.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Any questions for any of our testifiers? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions for Mr. Schwartzberg. Mr. Schwartzberg, I'm looking at the bill as it's been presented to the committee, and I'm looking at page 4 with regard to lines 4.1 through 4.13. And before I go there, Mr. Chair, I guess I would like for Mr. Schwartzberg to describe for us, the payment structure that, or the compensation that typically is realized by working in this field, Mr. Chair.
All right. Mr. Schwartzberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for your question. If I'm understanding your question correctly, are you asking us what is the approximate salary or the approximate fees that music therapists charge in the community?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may respond.
Mr. Schwartz.
We are given approximate data from our American Music Therapy Association once a year that looks by region. And currently, Minnesota resides in the Great Lakes region of the American Music Therapy Association. On average, that survey seems to indicate that music therapists are charging approximately between $40 and $50 an hour for services. Part of the rationale behind licensure in the state of Minnesota is to ensure that constituents in Minnesota that are seeking music therapy receive it from a trained and qualified board-certified music therapist. And many music therapists in Minnesota are trying to help our clients save money and have access to our services. Some of us, and we had let me see if I can find this real quick. We had a quote from a colleague at McPhail Center for Music who says, thanks, who says that under the Affordable Care Act and the Mental Health Parity Addiction and Quality Act of 2008, music therapy would be a service with mandated coverage. However, the only barrier for this now is the lack of formal licensure in the state of Minnesota. So many individuals, while they are able to have access to our services, they might not be able to pay for our services. As I stated, that is an average fee that is reported through a survey that is conducted by the American Music Therapy Association.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and my next question actually would go to Mr. McGrath. Mr. McGrath, on page 4 as well as page 5, there is the delineation for a substantial amount of training, internship, and then on page 5 it speaks to the continuing ed requirement for this occupation. I'm just wondering if you have any knowledge of what that would compare to, say, any other continuing ed or minimum requirement for any other medical occupation, or if you might even compare it to someone in the financial services industry.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, these requirements are excessive. In the state of Minnesota, for example, we license emergency medical technicians, and all they need is 150 hours of training. And so the person who carries you out of this meeting and rushes you to the hospital, who you are dependent upon in terms of making sure you make it to the hospital, needs roughly a tenth of the type of training that is suggested here. Moreover, this is the codification of a private certification. This bill attempts to codify in state law private certification. This type of capture is at the heart of the problem. It is at the heart for two reasons. One, it's not necessary in that these musicians, I'm sure, are very talented, but they have gained private certification. So the market, the hospital, can get the signal from private certification. They do not need the government's blessing for that. And secondly, in the Affordable Care Act, there is great opportunity for this legislature to use any sort of market certification, any sort of market mechanism for people to qualify for insurance under the Affordable Care Act. You do not have to go to the most anti-competitive, most anti-restrictive, a mechanism that violates the Sherman Antitrust Act as being proposed here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Noonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In listening to Mr. McGrath, I am really perplexed because it sounds as if we want no licensure whatsoever. I want to make sure that if I go to a doctor that individual is licensed and trained and brought up to date on the latest techniques and the latest knowledge. And also, if I have an autistic child or one of my fellow veterans is suffering from PTSD, I want to make sure that someone working in the music licensure field or a music therapy field is fully licensed. I don't want someone who hangs out a shingle and claims to be a therapist when they really aren't. And I guess that's all I have to say about that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. We have a few people on the list. Mr. McGrath, real briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton, I am in favor of education. I am in favor of training. I am in favor of market signals. What I'm talking about is the problems that exist in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, for licensure for Statute 214, what the harm is to the public or could potentially be if this is not licensed.
Chair.
Mr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. I'm looking at a summary of our 214 document, which we did complete back in 2014 at the request of Representative Mack at the time. And I'd like to quote two things out of our summary. False claims of music therapy services delivered by non-qualified individuals present physical, psychological, and/or emotional harm to vulnerable persons. Furthermore, non-credentialed and unqualified individuals claiming they provide music therapy are not trained in mandatory reporting and place children and adults in vulnerable populations at risk. Furthermore, according to Section 214.001 of Minnesota statute, licensure is the only level of regulation that ensures that the practitioner has met predetermined qualifications and persons not so licensed are prohibited from practice, thus protecting title and scope of practice protection. We have a national certification, the Certification Board for Music Therapists. However, it is not a regulating body. Thus, there is no legal recourse to address issues of consumer harm. By having a license to practice music therapy in Minnesota, there would be consequences for misrepresentation from the appointed and volunteer Music Therapy Advisory Council, defined in our bill, for claiming to offer music therapy when not a board-certified music therapist.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if someone is not licensed, not trained, how does that harm a patient if they play music or practice music therapy with that patient directly? What is the harm?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, thank you for your follow-up question. In my experience working with individuals with autism, both children and adults, there can be a propensity towards hypersensitivity or hyposensitivity to sound, to other stimuli such as proprioception, vestibular, tactile, visual, etc. The trained and qualified music therapist, through their undergraduate training as well as their master's and even their PhD training, receives a rigorous and robust opportunity to take a myriad of classes that prepares them to work with, in this example, appropriately engaging these clients in interventions that will not increase those hypersensitive situations. We may also work with individuals in hospice. We also may work with individuals who are receiving cancer treatment to take the time to carefully assess the types of music that they enjoy, to make sure that we don't use music that might bring up deleterious memories. And as we are engaging in our interventions, be them songwriting, active music making, or lyric analysis in this case, to be able to watch for the nonverbal cues, to be able to have the training and observing telemetry monitors and knowing when one's heart rate or respiration rate or pulse rate is increasing too high. We have that training, we have that experience, we have that continuing education as set aside by the Certification Board for Music Therapists. Another example that I might give as well might relate to those that present with cerebral palsy. I currently have a couple of clients present with mixed and also spastic cerebral palsy in my clinic. If I did not have the proper training to know when I might be hyperextending a certain muscle group, I could do harm to them. And if I don't know how to consult and collaborate with my physical therapist, if I don't understand what they're telling me and recommending to me and vice versa what I'm recommending to them, we could do very serious physical harm to our clients. So without being licensed, there are many other different musicians that are claiming to practice musical therapy or therapeutic music that do not have this diverse training in how to truly respect and treat and protect our clients from inappropriate therapy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to Mr. McGrath. I believe you mentioned the Carolina decision, and I'm sure we're going to hear about this a lot, so maybe could you do a quick summary of that and why you think that decision relates to this particular bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, the Federal Trade Commission has been skeptical since the Reagan administration about the anti-competitive effects of occupational licensing, and it has long wanted to divide the type of immunity that you enjoy as a state legislator and the type of immunity from antitrust litigation that licensing boards enjoy. And so it filed a lawsuit and litigated to the Supreme Court a case against the dental board regarding teeth whiteners. And the important decision that came out from the Supreme Court was that when boards are controlled by an industry, there must be active supervision. That the sovereign, the state of Minnesota, the state of North Carolina, must review every decision in terms of promulgation of rules, discipline against licensees, and discipline against non-licensees. And if the state of Minnesota does not review that, the board is not immune from antitrust litigation, and therefore could be exposed to treble damages. Since that decision, there have been approximately 15 lawsuits filed against occupational licensing boards across the country, raising this concern that these boards act autonomously with no sovereign oversight, and therefore it would be analogous to their meeting in a restaurant or in a conference room in their trade association and deciding who can be in and who can be out. And the Supreme Court has said that you just can't restrain trade in that way in the long tradition of the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Just one follow-up. Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is the fact that there needs to be some type of oversight over the board. That is the only thing that relates that decision.
There are two. That's the bright failure of this bill, that it does not provide any active supervision by the sovereign. The second is that there must be a clear articulation of the state's policy. Now, we've done that in 214, and the board must follow as the second element to ensure immunity. The board must follow state policy.
Okay, thank you.
So it's a two-pronged test, Representative Mason, and thank you for your question.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question goes to Mr. Schwarzkopf again.
Schwartzberg,
I'm sorry.
He's not a general in the...
Thank you, sir. Mr. Schwartzberg, you kind of laid out the description for the process under which a person would go through to become certified and be recognized as a music therapist. It seems a bit daunting that some would go on to be a master's, gain their master's, or even a PhD in music therapy. The odd twist for me is you're going after a master's or a PhD, which comes at no small price to the individual. But the construct that I find a bit disheartening, or you can elaborate for me, is you're doing so out of a love for the patients, no question about that, but for $40 an hour. It seems that there is a dichotomy in terms of the length, the breadth, and scope of the responsibility of the individual to accomplish what they need to do for what seems like a minuscule amount of compensation. So to my point, in your bill, or in the bill that Representative Newton has brought forward on page 9, there's a fairly lengthy section on subdivision 3 under disciplinary actions. Mm-hmm. There is subdivision 4 that talks about authority to contract. Mm-hmm. And then there is a nebulous section number 10 that speaks to unknown and as yet undetermined application fees, renewal fees, duplicate licensure fees, and the commissioner is responsible for all of those. So, to Mr. McGrath's statements, it certainly seems like there is, you're digging a very, very deep moat for people to have the inability to jump over unless they ask the bridge to be, the let down. My question is, why such a heavy price to pay for little or no request and fees, and a commissioner that's obligated to take care of your group? And I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Schwartzberg.
Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, thank you very much for your questions. To your point about the levels of degrees that music therapists receive at our nearly 74 institutions across the U.S., we are a bachelor's entry level practice. So to practice as a board certified music therapist, one must go through their bachelor's in music therapy. And then, as you can see in the bill, also complete their internship as well. And then they can sit for the board certification exam. Once that's completed, they can practice. Those that go back for a master's degree, or even those that go back for a PhD, they do that to further the profession's research base primarily, and then potentially if they want to be professors at universities. Most of our practitioners here in Minnesota, and I have those numbers, where did I write that down? 50% of our music therapists in Minnesota, according to a survey they completed in 2014, 50% are bachelors, music therapists, practicing music therapists. 45% hold a master's, and 5% hold a PhD. I can't speak to why the cost for services is what it is. I know that my colleagues, or I can speak for myself, we love what we get to do. And this bill is truly here to protect our clients and to increase accessibility for our clients to our services. To be honest with you, I did not go into this profession, and I won't continue in this profession to make $100 an hour or make $200 an hour. If for some reason that happens down the road, that's an interesting thing that might happen with the economy. We do what we do because we love to get to do it, and we're simply here today, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to you about how to further protect our clients and increase accessibility of their services.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright, I think also when looking at this, I have a granddaughter who's a physical therapist, and I think that this is very closely in line with $40-$50 an hour to what a physical therapist receives for basically the same training as having a bachelor's degree. And I'm assuming that as they get more education, that the price probably goes up. I think it's very much in line with what we see for physical therapists. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going back to what Representative Schultz said, and I'll pose this question to you to the harm. Because I have had grandparents who were residents of nursing homes and elderly establishments, who on occasion were a participant in a music day at the retirement home. Are you suggesting then that type of means of invigorating their a day that needs to be regulated, and if they don't hold a license, that somehow the commissioner is responsible for punitive actions against that person who's strumming a guitar or playing the piano for the sake of those residents? I find it a very slippery slope that we're walking here.
Ms. Furman.
Thank you. That is just an excellent question, and that's really, I think, the crux of why we're here today, which is protecting the clients and the individuals we work with and helping the public understand the continuum that exists out there. So, for example, someone who is a musician who might go into the neonatal intensive care unit, that person doesn't have the same training as a board-certified music therapist who is aware of the impact of the tempo on the respiration and heart rate, of the infants in that setting, who is aware of the dynamic and the volume level and the impact on hearing that is critical at that age, as well as the impact of the construction of the music and how complex it is. All of that is part of the research and the training for a board-certified music therapist. In the situation of nursing home and healthcare, it's a wonderful place for a continuum of service so that there is a musician who might be playing and might be engaging residents. But the closer you get to the bedside, which is what they call it down at the Cleveland Clinic, the closer you get to the bedside and the more fragile and the more involved the clientele, you want to know when you have someone perhaps with post-traumatic stress syndrome who begins to cry, and have a person there who understands the impact of perhaps the music, the words, and what was happening, and can process it because they have the therapy background, not just the music. And so the counseling skills that are built into our continuing ed and into our curriculum, and it's being able to be aware of and clarify for the public that continuum, that a board-certified music therapist is different than a musician, and a license will help us clarify that in the same way that there are physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech-language therapists, and there are assistants in different levels of service.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I see that Mr. McGrath might have a response to that, but my follow-on question to the testifiers is, you mentioned that this is a national organization or has national representation. Why then did you not put the fee structure in there for an understanding in terms of why you are unclear in terms of what those fees should be set at as opposed to or compared to other states that might also have this program?
Mr. Schwartzberg.
Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, again, thank you so very much for taking the time to ask these questions. At this time, we have not considered or even begun to write a fiscal note with the commissioner or with our chief authors. We have heard indications from other states, the other seven states that have either licensure or other regulation, that it's approximately $50 to $75 I believe a year. Is that what we're hearing?
Georgia.
Yeah, approximately 50 to 70. That was Georgia? Okay. So Georgia, who does have a license, it's $50 to $75 a year for licensure in the state. I also just wanted to, if you don't mind, I wanted to just kind of reiterate and emphasize what Amy just said. I used to have the privilege of working in a long-term care center, Walker Methodist Health Center on Bryant. And I was a certified, I was a therapeutic rec coordinator for an end-stage dementia unit. I provided music therapy for patients who were on hospice. I provided co-treating with physical therapists, occupational therapists, and speech and language pathologists in the rehab center and on the rehab floor. But I would also once a month invite in some tremendous musicians to perform on my unit. And oftentimes I would have musicians performing on the weekends and in the evenings for my residents. By no means are we wanting to tell those folks to cease and desist. They are tremendous musicians, and they provide a tremendous opportunity for improving the quality of life of those amazing folks at our long-term care centers. However, their work is not therapy. Our work follows a very clear therapeutic process, starting from assessment to choosing the appropriate evidence-based approach, to being able to create a goal, objective, and treatment plan, and to be able to monitor if our interventions are being effective. And if they're not being effective, how do we change it, and what do we do about it? And then also considering what is an appropriate discharge plan. So there is a difference here between what a trained board-certified music therapist can do and what some incredible music entertainers can do, such as the instance that you brought up. Thank you.
All right. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this will probably be directed to Mr. Schwartzberg. As we're taking a look at the requirements, originally I was first struck by, you know, how many hours of clinical training that were required. And what I was wondering is, I've been listening more and more and understanding that it's more of a therapy in line with a physical therapist or somebody in the mental health field. How do the hours that you have here compare to the hours that are required at the similar level in either physical or a mental health therapist?
Mr. Chair, we're going to bring up our third testifier to answer your wonderful question.
Ms. Els.
With your permission. Our hours for continuing education?
As I take a look at what I was looking at is the place where it was talking about completing a minimum 1,200 hours for clinical training, the internship, and then the ongoing experiences.
For the bachelor's level entry degree and then board certification, it is comparable to our allied health professionals. Now physical therapists are moving, they've moved towards a doctorate level in their entry as well. There's certain mental health professions that have a master's level entry, but at present, our board certification recognizes a bachelor's level entry. That's with approximately 1,200 hours of an internship followed by the exam. So it's comparable.
Okay, thank you. That helps as I'm taking a look at it. I can understand on the therapy part how music can have a touch people in very different ways, and I, from my understanding right now, is if, that almost anybody can hang their shingle out and say they're a music therapist, and actually they may be doing more damage than harm. And I can see that as a society, we should be able to protect people. I too often see people who are preyed upon, who are in disadvantaged situations or usually lower income, who are easily taken advantage of, and we need to have some kind of standards to help make sure that if people are expecting a certain level of therapy, that they're being provided what they're paying for, to make sure that we're keeping qualified people versus shyster who might want to try to take advantage.
Mr. Chair, we concur with that statement. Thank you.
All right, I think Mr. McGrath had one final comment, and then Representative Noonan, if you have any closing thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. One of the things that would be important to clarify is that under Statute 214, this committee and this legislature has lots of alternatives. It does not have to go to the most anti-competitive, most restrictive, most rent-seeking, most anti-opportunity type of legislation in occupational licensing. Instead, it can use registration. Alternatively, it can use certification. In certification, it is a title act, and in Minnesota, we certify interior designers, for example. And so if the proponents of this legislation are making an asymmetrical information argument that the buyers of these services don't have sufficient information to judge who's good and who's bad, who's competent and who's incompetent, that is wrong for two reasons. One is that there are hospitals. I'm sure the Mayo Clinic understands the difference between qualified and unqualified practitioners. And then secondly, that if you have a signaling problem, the best way to address a lack of information is through certification, because you send the market signal as to who has met the personal qualifications necessary to be certified without the high costs and anti-opportunities that are inherent in occupational licensing. So the entire argument that is being advanced here by the proponents, the entire rationale, can be addressed by a far less restrictive type of regulation that is used in Minnesota, and that is certification. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Representative Noonan, before I get to you, I have one final question from Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. It just occurred to me. Representative Noonan, or maybe the other testifier could answer this. I'm just curious. With your services, can you bill Medicaid and Medicare without this licensing?
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, Representative Lohmer, thank you very much for your question. There are some inconsistencies, and we've heard this from our colleagues around the state. It appears that some of our colleagues are being told we can reimburse you through the CDCS waiver, the TBI waiver, other types of waiver programs. And then other music therapists are being told, because you are not licensed in the state, we cannot and will not allocate dollars to you. We've also heard the same from Blue Cross and Blue Shield as well. So here exists an inconsistency, and we believe that that inconsistency may be resolved by the opportunity to not only demonstrate title protection and title regulation, but also scope of practice as well, just as our other related health professionals, such as occupational therapists, physical therapists, and speech and language pathologists.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Newton, closing thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very interesting. I once again strongly support this bill. I think it's terribly important that we license anyone that's dealing with either the mental health or the physical health of residents of Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to ask that you and the committee consider laying this bill over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services bill.
Thank you, Representative Newton. With that, House Bill 2366 is laid over.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
And before we go on, thank you very much, testifiers. Mr. McGrath, if you want to stay snuggled up there, you can.
I'd love to, Mr.
All right.
Mr. Chairman. Thank
we
you.
Now have a quorum, so we can go back. There's a copy of the rules for our subcommittee, which we need to adopt. They're in your packet. They are nearly identical to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. If I can take a motion to adopt that, the subcommittee rules.
Mr. Chair, I would make that motion.
Representative Albright makes the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? And our rules are adopted. Looks like we have treats. That's my favorite part of this meeting.
Oh,
you want to share?
I'm sorry. I thought Representative Noonan gave those to me.
I gave very clear instructions, Representative Albright.
You don't really want.
All right. We'll now move on to House Bill 978, and if there are no objections, I'll go ahead and move the bill from up here. If everyone's okay with that, I'll move House File 978. We have the bill before us. I have an author's amendment. It's entitled 978A1, and I'll move that amendment. It's a technical amendment getting the bill in the shape in which we'd like to discuss it today. That should be in everyone's packets. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And the A1 is adopted. So I'll just talk very briefly about this piece of legislation. It is licensure for the genetic counselors, a highly trained and specialized group of healthcare professionals who frequently practice in integrated healthcare settings. As this setting and as the science, quite frankly, has grown, this profession has changed, and the regulatory system currently used in Minnesota has failed to keep up. Unlike doctors, nurses, physician assistants, or any other advanced healthcare professional, genetic counselors are not currently licensed, and the state of Minnesota has no ability to regulate the practice of genetic counseling or remove an individual from practice who is thought to be practicing in an unsafe manner. Additionally, genetic counselors are not eligible for the state's monitoring program, the Health Professional Services Program, which I think is a pretty significant issue when we're dealing with healthcare professionals that are quite really on a day-to-day basis giving life and death recommendation to parents, to family members, to cancer patients, to to mothers or fathers-to-be. It is a significantly heavy weight on these practitioners' shoulders, and I think it would be irresponsible, as the science has evolved and the field has grown, to continue in a practice that doesn't more effectively observe and monitor and regulate this profession. I have several testifiers with me this afternoon. If you can introduce yourself and begin, and we can get started.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Joy Larson Heidley. I am a board-certified genetic counselor who resides in Maple Grove. I work in clinical cancer genetics at North Memorial's Humphrey Cancer Center. And in addition, I'm the immediate past president and a member of the board of directors for the National Society of Genetic Counselors. I'm also a clinical supervisor with the Genetic Counseling Graduate Training Program at the University of Minnesota and a member of the Minnesota Genetic Counselor Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 978, as it's important legislation that would provide licensure for certified genetic counselors in Minnesota. Genetic counselors are healthcare providers with significant training and expertise in molecular biology, medical genetics, psychosocial counseling, obtained through a two-year master's level program. Most students enter the field from a variety of disciplines, including biology, genetics, psychology, and public health. There are currently 32 accredited training programs in the United States, and this number is growing as more academic centers of excellence begin to focus on precision medicine. The genetic counselor profession is one of the fastest growing in the United States. Since 2006, there's been an 88% growth in the profession, and it continues at a rate of about 7% per year. Right now, there's more than 4,000 genetic counselors in the United States. We are part of a healthcare team and provide information support to individuals and families concerned about risk of genetic disorders. As part of our job, we collect and interpret family and medical histories. We identify individuals and families who are at risk for genetic conditions. We'll explain the inheritance and natural history, quantify the chance of occurrence and recurrence, and review available testing options. We discuss management, prevention, and research opportunities, and we also serve as patient advocates and refer individuals and their families to community or state support services as appropriate. Genetic counselors are employed in a wide range of clinical care, academic, laboratory, research, and biotechnology settings. Within Minnesota, there are over 100 genetic counselors, most of whom provide direct patient care in a variety of settings that include but are not limited to obstetrics, oncology, pediatrics, neurology, and cardiology. There are also several genetic counselors working in the Minnesota Department of Health on public health genomic programs, including newborn screening and follow-up. The availability of genetic and genomic testing services is growing rapidly, with about 10 new tests per day entering the market. Not only have there been more tests, the complexity of the test is changing. Licensure of genetic counselors in Minnesota is consistent with the 21 states that have already enacted licensure laws. North Dakota, South Dakota, Ohio, and Nebraska are states in the Midwest that are currently licensing genetic counselors. In order to ensure that the public is protected and that genetic counselors are able to practice to the full extent of their training in Minnesota, we're hopeful that you will enact House File 978. NSGC is also helping genetic counselors pursue licensure in more than 20 additional states, with the ultimate goal of having licensure in all 50 states. We feel this House File 978 is extremely important, as the bill would help protect the public from potential harm that may result from this occupation remaining unregulated. Harms that could be caused by untrained individuals attempting to provide genetic counseling include misinformation regarding genetic risk or lack of risk, the misunderstanding of the implications of genetic information such as family history or test results can lead to unnecessary medical treatment or surgery, lack of prevention or disease monitoring strategies, irreversible medical management decisions, avoidable fear and unnecessary anxiety. It can also reduce inappropriate ordering of costly genetic tests. With our specialized training, genetic counselors are ideally suited to work hand-in-hand with physicians and healthcare providers to ensure the delivery of high-quality, up-to-date genomic services and to make sure that patients utilizing these services are adequately informed. As such, we are key players in appropriately integrating genomics into healthcare and in avoiding the significant harm that can occur when genetic risk is not identified or when the patient is not properly counseled prior to testing. Genetic counselors, our services are cost-effective. We assure that tests are utilized appropriately. Many healthcare providers often request unnecessary tests, or they've ordered the incorrect genetic test, which increases the cost of healthcare. Non-genetics healthcare professionals have also been demonstrated to underestimate patients' genetic risk because of ineffective family history evaluation. For genetic conditions, roughly half of the first-degree relatives, which are your siblings, your parents, or your children, of a person with an inherited risk factor also carry that mutation and have the chance of passing it on or developing the disease of at question. Many health plans and hospitals require licensure to credential a healthcare practitioner. The absence of licensure impedes the delivery of genetic counseling services in these cases, as genetic counselors are not permitted to practice to the full extent of our training. Licensure would allow the genetic counselor to practice to the full extent of our training and will improve access to these services. Many states have seen an increased demand for genetic counselors after licensure has been implemented. For example, just last year in Ohio, at Ohio State University, licensure allowed the credentialing to occur, and in their oncology department was able to create several genetic counselor clinics that increased access for patients to be seen. In their experience, they had 6 patient slots per week, went up to 16, and required the addition of additional genetic counselors. States that do not have the licensure have had a hard time attracting new graduates to the state to practice. These circumstances could place Minnesota at a disadvantage compared to the other states, and it could result in loss of employment, revenue, and a tax base. In addition, it can decrease patient access to the specialized service. In summary, genomics is changing rapidly, and genetic counselors are key players in appropriately and effectively integrating genomic applications into healthcare. Clinicians and patients need to know that the genetic counselors that they work with and are seeing in clinic are adequately trained and up to date on genomic information. NSGC and MNGCA urge you to enact the legislation as it would establish requirements for licensure genetic counselors, ensuring the minimum standards for individuals in terms of academic achievement, clinical experience, and the skills necessary to deliver high-quality genetic services. Currently in Minnesota, there is no legal standard for who can represent themselves as a genetic counselor. As the field of medical genetics grows, there is and will continue to be the need to provide citizens of Minnesota with accurate information regarding their genetic risk and the results of the test. At present, there's no mechanism to ensure that citizens, that the individual who's providing the information to them is qualified to do so. In a climate where direct-to-consumer genetic testing via internet companies is widely available and where the complexity of genomic tests is increasing, the citizens of Minnesota deserve to have access to professionals who have been deemed qualified by the state to help them understand their potential risks. So NSGC and MNGCA thank the chair and the committee members for your attention to this important issue, and we offer ourselves as resources as you move forward with this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Heddle.
Good morning. My name is Terry Woodhall, and I'm a resident of Minnetonka, Minnesota. I'm here today because this issue has impacted me personally. I have an inherited gene mutation, and I'm currently a cancer patient. But I believe that my cancer journey could have been different if I'd had earlier access to qualified genetic counseling services. If you would indulge me for just a minute, I'd like to share my personal story. I've known since I was a little girl that the women in my family would die of breast cancer. My mother died of breast cancer at 46 in 1990. Her mother had breast cancer. Her mother's mother had breast cancer, and her maternal cousin. When my mother died, her oncologist told us that they thought there was some inherited aspect to this disease. And so with a lot of research, I found out that Mayo Clinic here in Minnesota was doing a study to see if preventative surgeries would possibly lower the risk for families affected by this strong family history. So after consultation with many doctors and my family, in 1993, I had a preventative mastectomy at the age of 30. Interestingly enough, a year later, the breast cancer gene mutation was found. And by the late 90s, it was in clinical practice. My doctors and I discussed the test, but at the time there were barriers to my doing the test. Cost, some concern about my future insurability, and we thought that I had done everything that I could to prevent my risk of breast cancer. I had a young daughter, and so my reason for having a test would have been for my daughter's sake, but we thought we had until she was an adult. So I went on with my life, happy and healthy. I celebrated the year that I outlived my mother. Fast forward to the fall of 2010, when my world and my family's world was completely upended by a diagnosis of advanced ovarian cancer. At the time of my diagnosis, I went to see a genetic counselor with the urging of my doctor. And what my doctors and I had not known was that although the gene is called the breast cancer gene, the Angelina Jolie, right? I also had a significantly higher risk of developing ovarian cancer. And I had not been able to take advantage of the preventative measures that I could have. In the last 5 years, I've undergone 4 surgeries, 2 rounds of intensive chemotherapy, followed by a year of maintenance therapy. And I currently travel every 4 weeks to San Francisco in order to be a part of a clinical trial. The purpose of the trial is not to get rid of my cancer, but simply try and keep it from advancing for as long as we can while I try and have the best quality of life that I can. Which brings me back to the beginning of my story and why I'm here to testify today. Because I do believe that if I'd had earlier access to a qualified genetic counselor, my journey could have been different. Don't get me wrong, I don't blame anybody. My doctors, myself, we were simply dealing with the information that we had at the time as this science has evolved. I do as much volunteer work as I can because of the issue, and I talk to other families affected by this situation. And believe me, lack of access and bad information is still out there. Unfortunately, as Joy alluded to, with genetic tests now being available direct to consumer, one of my greatest fears is that somebody who doesn't have the proper education and training would create a genetic consulting business. They could advise patients on which tests to order, they could help them interpret them, they could give them advice on what to do about their results, and they could even sell them products that might help them with their situation. The cost of my personal lack of knowledge was high. Preventative measures would have been a heck of a lot less expensive than all of my ovarian cancer treatments have been. And my quality of life, I believe, would have been better. I hope that you consider these incredible costs and the real potential harm to your constituents when you consider whether or not licensure of the genetic counselors in Minnesota is necessary. I believe that access would be improved, but I sincerely believe that we need to make sure that those that are providing these types of genetic counseling services are truly qualified and capable of doing so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there, I think I have a...
Dr. Toler needed to return to the university for clinic.
Okay. Well, I apologize for not getting to Dr. Toler earlier. Mr. McGrath, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Zerwas. Members of the committee, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. We are a free market, public interest law firm and long advocates of sending market signals about what type of information is available to consumers about high quality providers. I thank you. It's a pleasure to sit next to you this morning, and I share your commitment toward sending market signals to potential consumers. Mr. Chairman, that can be done in less restrictive ways. As I pointed out earlier this morning, the state of Minnesota allows for you to select less restrictive means to address what has been described as an information problem, and that is either through registration or through certification. You do not have to close the field, particularly a field that is as new as this one in terms of providing, giving access to new and innovative practitioners of ever-changing technology. Interestingly, these private organizations are playing an important role. Private organizations have, like the ones documented in this bill, have stepped forward to address that signal, to address that lack of information and to establish private certification programs. The state of Minnesota could well be within its powers and its fiduciary responsibilities to recognize those private certification programs through registration or through certification. You do not have to give those private certification organizations a monopoly by making them the only game in town and restricting opportunities for others, other new organizations to evolve. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, I expressed earlier some of my free market concerns about occupational licensing. Let me just offer two to my friends on the other side of the political spectrum. Occupational licensing in general is reverse Robin Hood. Unions tend, if you are concerned about economic inequality, you should be very supportive of unions, because unions shrink the wages between upper level and mid level workers. By contrast, occupational licensing exacerbates economic inequality, transferring wealth to those who are generally well off from those who are not. Secondly, it blocks innovation and interstate mobility. Mrs. Obama has been instrumental in advocating for the free movement of military spouses and allowing them to move from one state to another. Occupational licensing restricts the type of interstate mobility that Mrs. Obama has so magnificently championed. And finally, it is contrary, occupational licensing generally is contrary to religious traditions. Pope John Paul II wrote that the obligation to earn one's bread presumes the right to do so. A society that denies this right cannot be justified, nor can it attain social peace. Finally, Mr. Chairman, my third point is that once again, this bill suffers from the vulnerabilities it is of the Supreme Court's decision, and it is unfortunate that it does not reflect a one-year-old precedent. Now, a landmark precedent that counsels this committee not to engage in this type of regulatory capture by trade associations. It would be far better for this committee to review this bill through the light of the North Carolina Dental Board Committee and not in, and have a much more competitive means of providing these very important services. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Ms. Waddell.
Yes. So I'd like to clarify one piece. That is about the certification process. So for us, we are board certified genetic counselors through the American Board of Genetic Counseling. That is a certification that I earn on academic merit that cannot be revoked as long as I'm maintaining my continuing education requirements. It does not give a patient or the public the ability to report cases of harm. If I am not doing my job well, licensure is in place to help the state make sure that people who are practicing in this field are doing so in an appropriate and safe manner. That helps the public be able to identify who is qualified and have a mechanism if we are not doing our job well.
Thank you, Ms. Whittle. And Mr. McGrath, Ms. Whittle brings up a great point. A contractor in the state of Minnesota is licensed, that they're bonded. If there's a complaint against them for faulty work, a consumer can go back after that individual. If I get faulty guidance from someone claiming to be a genetic counselor and that results in advanced cancer or a terminated pregnancy, what's my recourse in that situation?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. You have a wide variety of resources. One is the state of Minnesota could create a cause of action to allow you to sue. And that's what the bonding is all about, Mr. Chairman, that you speak about. It is to facilitate the type of litigation. Secondly, this committee could engage in empowering the Attorney General to address problems of fraud through existing Deceptive Trade Practices Act. You can go after the providers, the manufacturers of the test. You could go after the provider. You could have the Attorney General, as the Attorney General does on a regular basis, address fraud. You do not have to close the market to protect consumers. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, I would encourage this committee to review the frequency in which licenses are actually revoked by Minnesota state boards. One that I'm very familiar with is the licensure of attorneys. In Minnesota, we license approximately 24,000 attorneys. One would think, Mr. Chairman, that at least 1% should lose their license every year because of incompetence or fraud, or roughly 240. But the reality is that only about 8 lost their license last year. That is similar to the findings, the research that I've done in terms of Iowa doctors and Iowa dentists. This idea of revoking licenses really does not happen. This committee would be well served to, if that argument continues to be made, to research how often revocation actually occurs. And the reason it doesn't occur very frequently, Mr. Chairman, is because a license is a constitutionally protected piece of property. You are due a tremendous amount of process, and therefore boards are very, very, very reluctant to revoke a license.
Mr. McGrath, what about the health professional services program that affords resources and support to other licensed healthcare providers? What about the services that genetic counselors are missing out on by not being licensed to have those services availed to them? And in other words, if you have a practitioner that's in a difficult spot, whether it's through a family health crisis or a mental health crisis or a drug or alcohol or substance abuse issue, how come we would preclude this group of practitioners, which are providing patients life and death advice? Have a double mastectomy, don't have a double mastectomy. Terminate this pregnancy, don't terminate this pregnancy. Shouldn't there be more prescriptive oversight over a group of practitioners that is giving that type of clinical advice versus someone else that's maybe a little bit further removed?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is no. You do not need the heavy hand of the state to restrict entry into a field. Identify the problem that you want to solve. Do you want to solve fraud? Then you engage in a deceptive, you strengthen the Attorney General's Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Do you want to address misinformation? Then you enact a certification program. This bill, like so many in Minnesota, does not identify the problem that is attempting to address, and instead, if it does, it chooses a type of regulation far beyond what is necessary to address either fraud or information. Both of those legitimate consumer protections can be addressed through alternative means.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. For a second, I thought you were going to agree with me. No, I didn't. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This goes to the testifier, and I have two questions, Mr. Chair. The first is, in your initial testimony, you described the responsibilities of genetic counsel, but given the context of the information that a counselor would be dealing with, I'm wondering if you could open up and describe more, elaborately in terms of the coordination between the other providers to that a patient, such as the medical director, the other professionals in the room that you're coordinating your consultation with.
Ms. Waddell.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Mr. Albright. So as a genetic counselor, part of what my job is on the medical team is I work side-by-side with our physicians, the nurse practitioners, the other healthcare providers. They often will be making the referral to the genetic counselor for us to address a potential concern that they may have identified or that a patient has raised and would like to discuss further. So as a genetic counselor, when I'm taking that family history, I'm going to use cancer as the background because that's my subspecialty. I'm going to be taking a look at that family history. I'll assess what is the likelihood that you might develop a breast cancer or a specific type of cancer over your lifetime. I'll talk with you about what kinds of tests might be available to help address that risk further, talk with you about what the test can tell you, what it can't tell you, and probably more importantly is what would we do about that, either because of the result of the test or based on your family history. Because the rate at which genetic tests are changing, I mentioned that there's 10 a day hitting the market, it is very difficult for any provider who's not focusing specifically on genetics on a regular basis to stay on top of the changes in the technology. So that's where we provide an expert resource for our physicians that we're staffing with to assess the right test and the level of risk. We return the patient back to their physician to coordinate the medical management part of that care. So we'll make the recommendations, review the literature for them, and then they will be the ones to coordinate surveillance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have one follow-up. This sounds like the information that you're gathering, and I appreciate the Chair allowing me to maybe get a little far afield on this, but the data that you're collecting has some pretty severe and wide encompassing repercussions if it's not handled in the proper means, but also the dissemination to outside parties. I'm just wondering, from a data protection mm-hmm. perspective, where does that data reside? Who has access to it? And to the Chair's earlier comments about what repercussions are there for improper use of that data in other means? Mm-hmm. How can you assure against that?
Ms. Larson. Yes.
Thank you. So the genetic test results are housed inside the medical record, just like any other medical test that a patient might have. The people who have access to it, again, we follow the HIPAA rules and regulation. So whoever has access to that as the part of their healthcare team, and whoever the patient has given permission for us to share that information with. The repercussions, I appreciate that question quite a lot. If I don't interpret that test correctly, meaning if there's an actual mutation or risk factor that's identified, that information impacts you, it impacts anyone that's related to you by blood, and it impacts subsequent generations. So we do see significant impact when that is not interpreted well. We have, there is a piece of the test results that we get back. So in the world of genetics, our results are not black and white. There's a big gray area in between. And so we have something that we call a variant of uncertain significance. It means that there's a change that's identified, might make you and I different from each other, but might not have anything to do with the health condition that's in your family. Or it could be related to that condition, but there's not enough data to prove it. But it's my job to help collect what kind of information is known about that and help define steps that we can learn more information and keep in touch with you until we figure out what that means. Many times we've had patients where the provider misinterpreted that test result and they've sent patients on to get, for example, a prophylactic mastectomy, so an unnecessary surgery based on a variant. Variant's a question mark. We don't do anything with that for your care until we know what it means. So it's one example of a repercussion when this information is not used well.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that just statement, so is it the responsibility of the counselor to make the recommendation to the medical attending physician, or are you in collaboration and getting redundant validation of the assessment that you've made, and who's providing that determination to the patient, the medical physician, or you? I'm looking from a standpoint of liability to your earlier comments, Mr. Chair. Who's ultimately responsible for the determination of the prognosis?
Mm-hmm. So that, in part, comes down to our scope. For our scope of practice, it's our job to elicit and interpret those medical histories, review the literature, provide that information to the physician. Once we've provided the information to the physician, there isn't a lot of overlap that happens there because the vast majority of physicians, everybody's extremely busy. They're specializing in their area. Genetics, it's hard to keep current on genetics. We provide that information to our physicians, and they take over at that that point, and it's them that is directing the surveillance and the medical care. We are not directing them. We will provide recommendations as far as what's existing in the literature. A lot of the conditions we're working with are pretty rare, and providers may not have had experience with that before, so we're doing a lot to help our physicians take the best care of the patient.
Representative Albright.
No further.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, why is it important to renew the license annually rather than every 2 years?
I'd like to bring Melissa to.
Please introduce yourself, your name, and your affiliation for the record.
Yep, my name is Melissa Terulson. I'm a genetic counselor here in the state of Minnesota and the outgoing vice chair of the Minnesota Genetic Counselors Association. Mr. Chair and Representative, when we initially drafted our bill several years ago, we did have a license renewal every 2 years. Upon the recommendation of the Board of Medical Practice, we changed that to 1 year.
Thank you.
Can you explain, like, the why they recommended that change?
Mr. Chair and Representative, my understanding was that was a standard for the other professions that they also regulate with a license.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Representative Schultz?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'd like to respond to Mr. McGrath's comments. I understand that when you license, you disturb labor markets.
Thank you.
But the flip side is that you need to do a thorough benefit cost analysis. That is it worth it to disturb the labor market and offer a license to protect consumers and patients? So you could litigate, and it would be fairly costly. So there could be a huge cost in litigation, and there could be a savings to licensing. So. You know, I accept the argument that you disturb labor markets and therefore wages, but the other side is that there are some benefits to that, and until we see the full cost-benefit analysis, I just can't accept that argument that we shouldn't license any occupation. You know, I don't want voodoo medicine to come back, especially if it's anything like voodoo economics, but thanks.
Mr. McGrath!
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm in favor of cost-benefit analysis as well. It's very difficult to do. And the staff here at the state of Minnesota does not have the econometric skills to engage in that type of analysis. And this is why my proposal is based on a simpler type of analytical tool, which is to identify the consumer protection concern that is at the heart of the proponents, and then find the least restrictive means to address that consumer protection. And so it is not, I am not hugging Milton Friedman this morning. What I am suggesting to you is that there are alternative ways. Once you have identified the consumer protection concern that you have, there are less restrictive ways to address those concerns, which should be your first level of analytical scrutiny. And then when you want to look at costs, you can look at the costs that getting to your analysis next, you can look at the cost that licensing imposes. Here in the state of Minnesota, the leading scholar in the world is at the University of Minnesota, and he's estimated that the costs of licensing, as we do in this state, cost about 15,000 jobs, $3.5 billion a year, or roughly $1,000 for every family in the state of Minnesota. So there are real costs to be avoided, and I'm suggesting is that there are proper ways to meet consumer protection concerns through less restrictive types of regulations.
One follow-up to that. If we don't license, the state could be liable. So if a female does not get the appropriate genetic counseling, their life ends early, and their family sues the state. The cost of the early death could be, you know,
fairly large. I don't know, $20 million. There's economists that do cost of a human life, and you can add that up pretty quickly. So 15,000 jobs may seem like a lot, but it's really not a lot, and that the state could be liable if we're not protecting consumers from early inappropriate procedures.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schultz, that's incorrect. The state of Minnesota is not liable for the malpractice of medicine. In fact, the opposite is true. When you license a board and you restrict, you displace competition, as this bill does, you are exposed to antitrust violations. And these boards and the state could be sued for treble damages. So there is no malpractice. To summarize, there is no malpractice, as you suggest. There is no right to sue the state for its decisions, and there is liability for the type of legislation that is before this committee.
Well, I guess I disagree, because we offer, the state funds public health insurance programs, and we are providing coverage and medical care to many individuals. So I guess it depends on what type of coverage a person has and who that individual is. But I do believe that the state could be named in a lawsuit. And we're talking about here in this committee, so if we decide not to license, we're making a decision that's not protecting the state.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGrath, I am suggesting this binary thinking between license versus no license is absolutely incorrect. And I repeat myself, which is that you do not have to engage in this binary analysis of license versus no license. If you identify a real consumer protection, you should attempt to find the regulation that addresses that. And licensing, you do not often have to get to licensing to address that consumer protection.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Representative Albright.
I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, under Section 6, you're describing the continuing education requirement. And after an initial application, it identifies 10 hours. I find that to be a bit almost amusing in light of the severity of the work that you're doing. And if you compare that to CME, mm-hmm. And whatnot for a similarly serious nature, I'm just curious why there was not more consideration made of the continuing ed requirement here, as we heard in the previous bill.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Albright, thank you for raising that. Right now, the continuing education that's used here is that's put forward by the American Board of Genetic Counseling, and part of the difference is in the units and how it's applied. For us to have 1 hour of continuing education, we actually receive 0.1 CEUs. So by the time we're getting 10 CEUs, we're actually closer to 100 hours of education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any final questions? Otherwise, I'll wrap up this one. Well, thank you to the testifiers. Thank you, members. I'll be brief in wrapping this up. I think, you know, while Mr. McGrath, you know, raises a valid point about building fences and impacting the ability for new people to enter into this area for employment, I would say that we need to look at consumer protection on a much greater scale than a lot of other professions that are already currently licensed in the state of Minnesota. If you look at someone as close to the patient experience and the patient guidance for what to do next in seeking medical treatment, I think you look at a vulnerable cancer patient or a vulnerable pregnant woman and imagine the loss that they're at to try to navigate these results. And as been said by our testifiers, it's not the black or white. It's the, if you interpret this part of your family history and this portion of your condition that may have a genetic component and this part of a condition that may have an environmental component, and then figuring out what the likelihood and what's best for a treatment plan for you to move forward. I would ask the committee to put themselves in the shoes of a young family who's expecting their first child. You know, the husband has a heart defect and the wife does not, and they're trying to figure out, is my husband's heart defect genetic? Can it transfer from him to our baby? Or is it environmental? Or is it a combination of the two? And what type of genetic tests, if possible, can be done in order to determine it's okay, relax, take a deep breath, everything's going to be okay. And what I want is I want the very most qualified person that can we can possibly have in our healthcare team to make that decision and to bring that advice forward, and for a patient and their family to be able to evaluate that. That's why I'm pushing the bill. That's why I think it's important. Thank you very much, testifiers. Up next, we have Representative Norton. Oh, and before I forget, we will go ahead and lay House File 978 over for possible action later on. You have some handouts? Ms. Johnson, I'll help you with the handouts. Representative Norton, we have House File. I'll move House File 220, and we'll have the bill before us. I understand you have an author's amendment, DE1. I will go ahead and make the motion and move your amendment if you'd like to speak just briefly to your amendment.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for having us here and hearing House File 220. This is a bill that's been around for a number of years, and because of some of the concerns raised here and in other states, the compact's done some work and has made some revisions, and we have an enhanced nurse licensing compact to bring before you, and the DE1 amendment is that new compact.
Thank you, Representative Norton. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would prefer, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? And the DE1 is adopted. Representative Norton, to your amended bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Some of you may recall that the Nurse Licensing Compact bill passed with bipartisan support in both the House and Senate in 2012. But that bill was not brought out of conference committee. It stayed there through the end of session and died. We believe that today we're bringing an even stronger bill that is more needed today than it was at that time due to the quickly changing high-tech medical world, as evidenced by the recent passage of the telemedicine bill and the physicians compact, and frankly, a lot of the testimony you heard already here this morning. Since not every legislator's had an opportunity to hear that 2012 testimony and the fact that changes have been made to the compact to address concerns we heard and have responded to, I'm going to give a quick overview of the compact and then ask Shirley Brecken from the Board of Nursing to share some thoughts, and I have two other testifiers here, Mr. Chair, as well. The Enhanced Nurse Licensing Compact is a legal agreement between two or more states that allows recognition of a nurse licensure in good standing in all states that participate in the compact. And I think that's currently 25 or 26 states. This is a mutual recognition model comparable to how states treat driver's licenses. That is, you apply for the license in the state where you live. You must meet those state standards and pass the test. You have to, but once you have that license, then and in this case, it would be the multi-state compact license, you could drive or work or call into other states, and they would recognize the license that you have. And just like with the driver's license, you are expected to obey the lights in the states where you drive, or in this case, where you would practice your nursing skills. Nurses in every state require passage of the NCLEX, NCLEX, or I don't know what the proper term is, to obtain a licensing, a nurse license in every state. It's the same exam. The Enhanced Nurse Licensing Compact sets a uniform set of standards and heightened safety requirements, including background checks and fingerprinting, and we can talk a little bit more about that later. The Enhanced Compact will support continuity of care, allowing nurses to provide follow-up care and services online or via telephone to patients who receive treatment in a Minnesota facility but might return home to another state without having to purchase a license in each of those states. This compact will also benefit traveling nurses and those nurses living and working along our border states. With the Nurse Licensing Compact, nurses are permitted to practice in the other compact states both physically and electronically, again, subject to the laws in each of those states. This will expand the role of nursing, provide more job opportunities for the great nurses in our state who are currently restricted under our border state agreement that allows nurses on all of our border states to come into our state and practice with their license, but Minnesota nurses are required to purchase licenses in those states in order to work across lines. And the reason for that is because those other states belong to the Nurse Licensing Compact. Two handouts before I go on. I passed out three. One of those handouts is a description of the old Nurse Licensing Compact. The underlying items are the changes that have been made. So as you see the handout that went around, it's the underlined items that have changed. The second one, if you flip it over, has a map, and it shows you what states belong to the compact. I'm not sure it's 100% up to date, but almost, if it's not. That will help you understand when you look at Minnesota that we're an island among compact states. And I'm going to share this as a frustrating side note on my part. In 2012, when we talked about this bill and we raised the issue of the border state problems, we were told at a very high-level meeting that this did seem unfair and that surely there would be another way to address the border state nurses without joining a compact. And I have to say, here we are, years later, no attempt, to my knowledge, was ever even made to address that issue, and again, our nurses continue to be at a disadvantage. Other changes to the Nurse Licensing Compact that are underlined will be addressed, I think, by Shirley Brecken here in just a moment, and others. I do want to close by mentioning the effective date situation. Because this is an enhanced Nurse Licensing Compact, every state that was a member of the compact has to renew that at their legislature. That is currently in the process of being done. And as a, and then we would be a new joiner at the same time. Assuming passage, then the bill, the new Nurse Licensing Compact, goes into effect the earlier of these one of these two dates, and that is when 26 states adopt the compact or December 31st, 2018. So just so we're clear about that. So that's those are my opening comments, Mr. Chair. I think if you wouldn't mind having Shirley Brecken from the Board of Nursing talk about this, and then you can proceed with the other testifiers or however you choose.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Ms. Brecken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. My name is Shirley Brecken. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Nursing. Representative Norton explained to you that this is an enhanced compact from the one that is currently in effect in 25 states. And I just want to give you just a bit of a background how that occurred. Approximately 3 years ago, boards of nursing got together and recognized that while the compact has been in effect for 15 years, the most recent that a state had passed it was about 5 years ago. And the concerns that were raised by states that were not currently in the compact had to do with things such as related to licensure requirements, that sort of thing. So the boards got together and said, you know, what is it that is keeping other states from joining the compact? It's been in effect for 15 years. It's been very effective. And at the same time, the compact administrator group had been looking at some changes to the compact that they felt needed to be made in terms of its operation. So that's how we come to the current compact or the enhanced compact that's before you today. there's what I see to be three major areas of change. The first one has to do with the fact that in Article 3 now, the licensure requirements are uniform. In other words, in order to get a multi-state license under the compact, every individual must meet these requirements. And I would tell you that these requirements are of a higher nature than we currently use in Minnesota to license nurses. And the rationale for that is that, and I think you can expect that, is that some states had things such as bars to licensure for conviction of certain crimes. Some states did not require criminal background checks, biometric criminal background checks. Some states did not provide for individuals to not have any encumbrance on their license as they move from state to state. So what these uniform licensure requirements did was raise the bar that if you're going to get a multi-state license that allows you to practice in any state that's in the compact, you have to meet these requirements. You might still be able to get a single state license in your state of residence based on the licensure requirements for that state. But if you want a multi-state license issued, you'll meet these requirements. You can never have been convicted of, in addition to graduation from school, passing the NCLEX, you can never have been convicted of a felony. You must submit to a criminal background check, fingerprint-based or other biometrics. You cannot be enrolled in an alternative program such as the Health Professional Services Program. You must have a valid Social Security number. And if you have been convicted or found guilty of a misdemeanor offense, it must be that's related to the practice of nursing, and that's determined on a case-by-case basis. You also cannot get a multi-state license. So that's a major change in the enhanced compact. The other two, what I would consider to be major changes in the compact, have to do with establishing the Interstate Commission of Nurse Licensure Compact Administrators. Currently, there is a governance body for the current compact. It's called the Nurse Licensure Compact Administrators, or NLCA. This commission would serve the same purpose, that is to administer the compact. However, using the word commission is very common to interstate compacts, and in fact, last year when the legislature passed the physician's licensure compact, the term interstate commission is the one that's used to name that governance group. So it's the same as that. The other provisions that are a major change. One has to do with rulemaking. In the current compact, rules as they are promulgated must be passed in all 25 states. And this new compact gives the commission authority to promulgate rules related to the operation of the compact only. Does not have anything to do with practice in the state, can't anything like that, but it is the rules under which the compact is governed, how requirements regarding the national database and submission and timing for that, or things related to communication among the states. And finally, I think the other major revision has to do with enforcement of the compact. It provides for an improved dispute resolution process, and it provides for the ability of the commission to terminate a state from the NLC or from the compact in the event that they are in non-compliance with the rules or the operation of the compact and they do not come into compliance. So those are what I would tell you are the three major or the major changes as I see it in this compact. I would tell you that it was drafted in consultation with the Council of State Governments, which was the same organization that the Federation of State Medical Boards collaborated with in the development of the physician compact that the legislature passed last year. I did tell you just a couple of things that I think are really important to recognize is that the compact provides that any state who participates in the compact must provide data to the national database called NURSES, which is operated by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, submitting licensure and discipline data. And of particular interest is the fact that, one of the differences in the submission of that data to the NURSES database compared to what it is now is that if you are a member of a compact state, and there is a violation of the law or a concern that is being investigated in any state in the compact regarding an individual nurse, that information goes into the database and it is shared amongst all the other states. I think that's very reasonable considering that a nurse can practice in all of those compact states. Currently, what happens is that information is not made known to other states until after public action has been taken. So there can be a length of time that the individual can move from state to state to state and continue to practice until there is public action taken against the license. The Nurse Licensure Compact provides for states to share that information before there is public action. It still provides for due process whatever state decides to move and take in with the investigation on that particular individual who may or may not have violated the law, the due process laws that are in effect in the state of licensure do apply. That doesn't change. I would like to share with you that, as Representative Norton said, currently the states of Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota, and South Dakota are our border states. A number of years ago, when this compact first came into the legislature, an agreement was made between the Minnesota Hospital Association and the Minnesota Nurses Association to allow or provide that the Board of Nursing in Minnesota must recognize the license of a nurse licensed in Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, or North Dakota as that license having authority to practice nursing in Minnesota. I can share with you that I know one of the concerns that's often raised is, well, some states don't have a requirement for continuing education hours. Wisconsin is one of those states. Those nurses from Wisconsin have been practicing in Minnesota under the border state registry law for that length of time, even though indeed they haven't met that continuing education requirement. There's actually nothing in the literature that supports that mandatory continuing education makes individuals safer. And in fact, what the literature does show is that even where it's not mandatory, nurses take more continuing education than they're actually required, and in fact the average is about 32 hours and that nurses are more likely to focus on their specialty or their need to know in all states, whether it's mandatory or not. The other thing that I point out to you is that there's nothing in the literature that supports that there's greater discipline or more problems with disciplinary action in those states where it is not mandatory continuing education. And in fact, Colorado, a number of years ago, based on that research and that the information that was available, actually removed the requirement for mandatory continuing education. I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding the contents of the compact, especially as it has been changed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken. Is it Tweedle? Twiddell. Apologize. And if we could keep this somewhat limited between 3 to 5 minutes, that'd be great, because I know we have more testifiers waiting, and we're going to be crossing the noon hour, and we're getting close to the witching hour, so we're going to try to move this a little bit. Thank you, Ms. Twiddell.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Diane Twiddell. I am a nurse and a chief nursing officer at Mayo Clinic Health System in southeast Minnesota, and I'm speaking on behalf of Mayo Clinic and Mayo Clinic Health System on the Nurse Licensure Compact. I've been a registered nurse for 35 years and have worked in the roles of staff nurse, nurse educator, nurse manager, and nurse administrator in a variety of specialties. As an organization, Mayo Clinic and Mayo Clinic Health System have hospitals with bed sizes ranging from 15 to 930. Mayo Clinic and Mayo Clinic Health System value nurses and believe that nurses are a key contributor to the delivery of high-quality, safe patient care. I'm here today to share that Mayo Clinic and Mayo Clinic Health System support Minnesota joining the Nurse Licensure Compact. At Mayo Clinic and Mayo Clinic Health System, we require our nurses to carry licensure for each of the states where they provide care. Our nurses who fly in Mayo One helicopter, our Mayo Clinic Health System nurse triage phone line, are all required to be licensed in Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. We strongly propose that having the NLC provides us with consistent safeguards in a national registry that is overseen by one centralized body. One of the NLC goals is to improve patient safety by creating and maintaining a seamless means of nurse licensure regulation. This is done by creating a comprehensive national database to facilitate sharing of licensure, investigative, and disciplinary action information. While this bill is not just about telemedicine, we believe adoption of this compact will help us begin to address a significant policy barrier to the delivery of medical and nursing services through telemedicine. The patchwork of state-by-state licensing presents a costly and time-consuming barrier to telehealth care delivery. Mayo Clinic sees adoption of the NLC in Minnesota as affording our nurses with the opportunity to provide their expertise and skilled services to our patients in our border states and throughout the country more efficiently. We are all working to provide our patients with the best health care. As technology and healthcare reform models move forward, the NLC will help provide clarity around newer mediums for providing care through telehealth, such as telenursing or nurse helplines. I'd like to provide a few examples of how telehealth is changing how patients receive care. Mayo Clinic initiatives in electronic ICU, intensive care unit monitoring, have shown great promise to improve patient outcomes and reduce healthcare costs. EICU offers 24/7 monitoring of patients from Rochester to Mayo Clinic Health System hospital sites in Wisconsin, Iowa, and southern Minnesota. Through constant surveillance and by providing the care teams with timely information, EICUs have been associated with a 55% reduction in ICU mortality and a 40% reduction in clinical complications. Our nurses are a key member of that ICU team. A recent Mayo randomized study published in Telemedicine and eHealth reviewed more than 200 patients who received either additional home telehealth monitoring or the usual medical care. The study's findings noted that these patients receiving care via telemedicine had less variability in cost of care, lower decedents to survivors cost ratio, and lower total 30-day readmissions. We recognize that our healthcare environment is changing. We need to be prepared to meet the needs of our patients and evolve to accommodate new models of care. The NLC helps break down state boundaries that are not relevant to providing patients with safe, quality care. We are committed to assuring the highest level of safety for our patients. The needs of our patients come first, and Mayo Clinic believes the NLC will help us best serve the needs of our patients while maintaining patient safety. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Twiddell. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brecken, or the representative, one of the concerns that I would have as I read through the bill is the scope of practice and the differences between the various states that would be adjoined to the compact. I'm wondering if you could give kind of elaboration in terms of if you have a nurse moving in from a state who has a more limited scope of practice to one where they have a broader scope of practice, but they are not credentialed. What parameters would you place on that individual to either inhibit them from practicing beyond the scope that they were formerly licensed for, or how do you prepare them to practice in an expanded scope in the state such as they would intend to do so?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, you are correct that it there is some variation from state to state, especially related to the practice of practical nursing. Primarily, professional or registered nursing tends to be much more standardized across states than practical nursing does. Representative Norton shared with you that it is very much, I think the analogy is the best descriptor, and that is the driver's license model. You may be licensed in Minnesota, and the speed limit on the interstate is 70 miles an hour, and you drive into Iowa, which the speed limit may be 65 miles an hour on the interstate. That's the law you have to abide by. You don't get to say, well, I'm from Minnesota, and so I can drive 70 on an Iowa highway. That's the same with nursing. You must practice to the scope of practice or to the laws of the state in which you are practicing, where the patient is located. That's true now. I, in the past, held a license in both Minnesota and North Dakota. And when I went to practice in North Dakota, on that North Dakota license, I needed to know the laws in North Dakota and practice to that scope. It may have been different from Minnesota, and in actuality it wasn't, but if it had been different, my professional responsibility is to know what the law is where I'm practicing nursing, where the patient is located. And that doesn't change whether I have a license in that state or I would have a multi-state license.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one follow-up for the sponsor of the bill.
Representative.
Representative Norton, on page 20 under the appropriation, you're allocating $149,000 for fiscal year 2017 with an annual increase of $6,000 for 18 and 19. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate in terms of what that money would go towards. Are you increasing an FTE count for current agency, or what would that money be allocated to and for what purpose?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. Representative Albright, I'm gonna defer the final answer particularly for the ongoing 6,000. But I do want to be clear to members of the committee and anyone listening, this does not mean the price that this is asking for state general fund dollars. It comes out of the special fund that's already funded by the nursing license, current nursing licensing funds that go into a special fund in our budget. So it's not coming out of our general fund. It's coming out of the nurse licensing fund within the current framework. So it's new money for the compact, but it's not new money to be collected. It's already there. So this is the general startup, and I'm going to let her talk a little bit about how the 179 came to be and what the ongoing six is.
Ms. Bracken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the initial base funding is really related to several things. First of all, it will take a significant education program, throughout the state to educate nurses and employers regarding the new law and what is a multi-state license and what does it mean. Secondly, there would have to be a lot in communication and postage to nurses who are licensed by the Minnesota Board of Nursing. For instance, an individual who is now licensed by the Board of that lives in Wisconsin but holds a Minnesota license would be required to get a Wisconsin license, and so there would be that communication that we would have to do in terms of the transition. There would be changes to the licensure database that we currently operate under at the Board of Nursing. There's a requirement of a $6,000 membership fee, annual membership fee for the that would be collected by the commission for the operation of the compact and commission expenses. So that's really what the funding is for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, I want to be cognizant of our time and be equitable to the other testifiers on this bill. I think we have before us Ms. Turner.
Andrea Altman.
Oh, I apologize.
That's okay.
Could you state your affiliation and introduce yourself to the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Andrea Altman. I am the System Director of Telecare Services at Essentia Health, located in Duluth. I'm also a registered nurse. Thank you for the opportunity to hear my comments on the compact agreement. At Essentia, in our pursuit of increasing quality of care, reducing the total cost of care, improving access to care, particularly for our patients in rural settings, while all the while remaining patient-centered, we have created many innovative RN-based programs at Essentia Health that leverage technology and provide our patients to 24/7 access to care through RN triage, RN prescription refill programs, and post-hospital discharge calls to our patients in an effort to reduce hospital readmission. Because Essentia Health has a multi-state geographic footprint, borders two states, we're burdened with maintaining triple licensure for our registered nurses who are serving patients within the states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and North Dakota. So being part of that compact agreement would significantly simplify our administrative processes of maintaining, securing, renewing multiple licenses for our RN staff. It would also reduce the unnecessary costs while still maintaining the quality of care, as you've heard from our other speakers here today. Let me know if you have any other questions, and thank you for hearing my comments today.
Thank you, Ms. Altman. Sorry about the mix-up. Do we have Matt Keller and Mary Turner from the Minnesota Nurses Association?
Hi, my name is Laura Sales, and I am a lobbyist with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We appreciate the opportunity to be here and learn more about the proposed revisions to the compact and other possibilities for adding language to the compact that could address some of our concerns. We had a meeting with Representative Norton and some members of the hospitals and the Hospital Association where they indicated that they'd be willing to work with us, add some language. And so while we haven't fully digested the delete all amendment that is before you, we appreciate the opportunity to be here, talk to you about why we've opposed it in the past, but be clear that we want to be part of a continued conversation, but we don't know yet whether these revisions have answered all of our concerns. So with that, I will turn it over to Mary and Matt.
Ms. Turner.
Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, my name is Mary C. Turner, and I'm the newly elected president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. I proudly represent the 20,000 nurse members of MNA, which make up 80% of the bedside nurses working in the hospitals in the state. I also continue to care for patients as a night shift neurointensive care nurse at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale. While we are discussing some legislation that could be changing as we speak, I think it's important for the committee to understand the nurses' objections to joining the Interstate Compact, at least in the form of the legislation that has been introduced previously. These are arguments based on principles that need to be addressed by any legislation going forward. I believe it's fair to say that joining the compact does not further the purpose of protecting the public or patients in Minnesota. Rather, the compact would affect the state in three different ways. It would lower Minnesota's standards to the lowest common denominator in nurse practice and training. It would allow out-of-state nurses to practice in Minnesota without board oversight or even board knowledge. And it would harm the employment opportunities of literally thousands of recent nursing school graduates who have decided to make caring for patients their life's work in Minnesota. First, this could lead to a lowest common denominator of state license standards. In this case, Minnesota would not have the ability to set licensure standards for nurses licensed in other states, yet these nurses are practicing here. For example, in Minnesota, nurses, technicians, and nursing assistants work as a part of a team. The registered nurse delegates patient care to both licensed and unlicensed team members. However, each state currently has different standards of which team member may delegate, what kind of care may be delegated, and who has the supervision and training necessary to perform the delegated care. This lack of uniformity will lead to inadequately trained staff delivering care that's beyond their scope. Second, compat state nurses will be able to practice in Minnesota without a temporary or provisional license from the Board of Nursing. This leaves open the question of where to turn regarding discipline for practice violations. Lastly, regarding nurse jobs, some people might argue that this would create jobs for Minnesota nurses across the country. I would rather see those well-qualified graduates begin their practice right here. We're currently graduating thousands of nurses who are waiting months to find openings at hospitals. Instead, those positions will go to less qualified applicants from outside the state. Then new nurses from Minnesota will have no choice but to leave. The quality of health care in the state is a matter of Minnesota pride. In closing, I remain open-minded that any future versions of the legislation could address these concerns and questions that I have, as well as those of the 20,000 nurses I represent. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Mr. Keller?
Mr. Chair, my name is Matthew Keller. I'm a nurse attorney with the Minnesota Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today about the new revised nurse compact. Just want to reiterate some of the positions that we've had in the past regarding the compact. Another concern that we've had is that compact legislates away the authority to determine who practices in this state from the Minnesota Board of Nursing to the compact administrators in another state. Ms. Brecken mentioned that Minnesota requires 20 hours of continuing education for our nurses to practice in the state. Wisconsin requires none. North Dakota requires 12 hours. South Dakota requires none. With all due respect to Ms. Brecken, having been a presenter of continuing education in the state, I will say that the majority of nurses who have attended my classes would not have been there were not for the requirement to have continuing education in the state. This also becomes a factor when you're talking about future standards for nursing practice in the state of Minnesota. If Minnesota were to have other requirements, for example, requirement to have a BSN in order to practice in this state, we would not be able to do that under the language of the compact. Second concern that we have is that although the medical compact has been mentioned several times today, the nursing compact is quite different from that. As opposed to the streamlined process that the medical compact legislated for requiring licensure in several different states, the nurse compact would require only one licensure. So just to clarify that a little bit more, the medical compact is not a mutual recognition compact. It's just a streamlined process to acquire medical licenses in several different states, which is different than the legislation you see before you today. Third, another issue that we've had with this legislation in the past is that it allows nurses to practice in this state without the knowledge or approval of the Board of Nursing. I will mention that we notice in this amendment that there is an attempt to address this on page 20.3, I believe, to 20.4. I would query whether or not this will be allowed under the language of the compact. We're not sure about that. We also take issue with the fact that it's using permissive language for the state to establish a registry of nurses practicing in this state rather than mandatory language. This legislation has been opposed by our parent affiliate, National Nurses United, which represents 185,000 nurses in this nation. It's also opposed by the American Nurses Association, Minnesota Organization of Registered Nurses, and has been opposed by MNA in the past. There's been a little bit of discussion about the Board of State Registry today. I would be happy to address those issues in other legislation. I will point out, though, that the Board of State Registry is very small. We're talking about 150 nurses approximately that are on that Board of State Registry compared to 90,000 nurses who have licensure in the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on this bill today? Any question from the members? Representative Norton, we'll turn it back to you.
Thank you very much. I think I'll just make a couple points here in closing, and then, again, if you have any questions, I'm always available as you consider this bill once session formally begins. One of the things we just heard had to do with nurses from our border states that don't require CEUs practicing in the state of Minnesota, and I just want to remind people that that currently is allowed in law, that we have nurses from North, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa, practicing in the state of Minnesota under the way it is right now with no CEUs. Having said that, I want to make it clear that the hospitals that hire nurses can set their own requirements for their employees, and that could be CEUs or additional training if they feel it's necessary. So I thought that should would be worth saying. And also, this is not just about nurses coming into our state. It is very much about, as you heard from the testimony earlier, allowing the great nurses in the state of Minnesota to follow their patients, provide telemedicine, and move outside of our state. And in fact, just as a reminder for some of you probably don't know this, but when I first came to this bill many, many years ago, I think it'll be 10 years ago now, it was because a constituent came to me who was a traveling nurse and was complaining about having to purchase multiple licenses as a traveling nurse. And so this, oddly enough, wasn't a bill brought to me by any of the people behind me, though it's been a pleasure working with all these folks. It was brought to me by a practicing nurse in the state of Minnesota, and I gave you a letter of an additional constituent of mine who is going to school at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and had to do a project. She studied this issue, and she wrote that letter. And again, she is an RN, works at Mayo Clinic, and she, too, says, my practice, the practice of nursing can be improved with the compact. So with that, Mr. Chair and committee, I thank you very much for hearing the bill, and I look forward to doing something more once session formally begins.
Thank you, Representative Norton. We will lay over House File 220. And members, as we're wrapping up today, just an announcement, and for folks in the audience, the Subcommittee on Licensing will meet next February 23rd at 1 p.m. in room... We have room 5, right? In room 5, right here, and we'll send out an agenda. I would imagine we'll have three or four bills that we'll hear that day as well. We might have to be a little bit more judicious with keeping on schedule so we don't stay here till 5 or 6 that evening, but the chair will do his best. And thank you so much for coming today. And with that, we're adjourned.